Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, discussion about healthcare and science in the news. Also, well, answers to your questions via email or telephone, and I'll be giving out those numbers in just a few minutes. But before I go there, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We had an interesting, a number of interesting things come up in the news this week, and we're going to start off with a couple of stories about immunology. We're currently really at a very interesting place technologically, and each technologic advance has a whole lot of ripples in other existing fields in medicine, and the genetics and our ability to do rapid throughput analysis of particularly genetic information, but also amplification of proteins is really, really hugely important. And in immunology, it's given people a whole new toolkit. One of these areas is in the development of artificial vaccines. Scientists are really learning to manipulate things on, the molecular level. Imagine that the immune system itself is a complicated factory with all sorts of inputs and outputs. And then imagine suddenly someone opens up a panel and you have these buttons in front of you, and you sort of know that these buttons turn on conveyor belts or turn off things or add things, but you're not really quite sure how it all works. And how are you going to figure it out? Well, you're going to start pushing buttons, and that's what they're doing here. They're pushing buttons. We're talking right now about a new breast cancer vaccine, one of a number of cancer vaccines that have come out in the last few years that are aimed at pushing those buttons on the immune system. In other words, this isn't a vaccine where it's attacking the cancer per se. You're not like the early melanoma vaccines, taking tumor, chopping it up, and basically creating monoclonal antibodies against it, which was what I thought of when I immediately saw that I was reading about immunotherapy vaccines for cancer. No, actually, this vaccine called GP2 has been used in this latest study in a certain subset of breast cancer patient. But the vaccine stimulates the CD8 cells, the so-called cancer or killer T cells. And what they do is they add this vaccine to a known immune stimulant called granulocyte colony stimulating factor, or CSF. This is commonly given in cancer to, revive the white blood cells that have just been smashed down by the chemotherapy drugs. And this trial, a combination of the drugs, was given to 190 patients with varying levels of HER2-new, which is a protein elaborated in certain types of breast cancer. In those circumstances, they were able to show a improvement in disease-free survival. Basically, the group that got the vaccine and the CSF factor, the colony stimulating factor, had a 94% disease-free survival, and this was compared with a 85% disease-free survival in the group that just got the colony stimulating factor, which is assumed not to have any direct immunological effect against cancer. So that's a substantial difference, and this was over 3 years' time. In this particular type, HER2-new aggressive cancer, there is a fairly rapid recurrence, and so 3 years is really quite meaningful. Most of these women had also received either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. So the thought is that this adds to the disease-free survival in this group, and really it's quite important. There are other vaccines that work on the immune system. There's one called AE37, which definitely showed improvements in women who were triple negative breast cancer. That's people with no estrogen or progesterone receptors and no HER2 new. And there's another one called E75. That one's actually got a name, Nuvax, and that's being tested internationally. Also, CD8 stimulant. So we're beginning to push those buttons with agents that are being produced through, well, truly designing an entity based on your knowledge of what the receptor looks like. Really very impressive stuff, and I'm looking forward to seeing where they take it. Another immune stimulator that's in the development is coming out of, this is general immune stimulation. And for this, I'll have to explain a little bit about what we think we know and what we now know, some recent discoveries in what trains a T lymphocyte to go out and start attacking infected cells. Now, we know that there are cells circulating around in both the brain and the bloodstream called dendritic cells, and variously also macrophages. They're big eaters, and they are like big amoebas in our bloodstream. When one of these big amoebas come across a bacteria, they ingest it and break it down and then select antigens, that is to say, usually protein sugar or pure sugar molecules that are unique to that bacteria, and they extrude them and display them, dangling them around on their surface so that they sort of look like little dandelions floating around in your bloodstream. The T cells come along and they're attracted to these extrusions, and there's a dialogue that occurs between the T cell and the macrophage, now become a dendritic cell, that activates and trains the T cell to attack a particular viral or bacterial antigen. Now, that process takes about 72 hours, and we've thought that it occurs primarily in the lymph nodes, but researchers at the University of Kiel have been looking at the liver, and they've discovered that the liver actually is also a very important immune organ, and this is new information. So there's a different mechanism that occurs in the liver, a natural messenger called interleukin-6, and another compound called SIL-6R activate and combine together. And then once these two are touching, they can stimulate in the liver the T cells that happen to be passing through. And since with every heartbeat, a large percentage of our blood goes through the liver, this is a very effective way of priming the immune system. The cool thing is that this reaction happens much faster. And because it's a chemical-based, in other words, a compound-based reaction using the IL-6 and this other component, it can be synthesized in the lab, and they have actually created a new synthetic designer messenger. They're calling it hyper-IL-6, and it can be injected, and you can bypass the liver and have this rapid stimulation of the T lymphocytes occur in the bloodstream. So this could be used for therapeutic purposes, and they're particularly looking at it right now in the idea of augmenting a vaccine reaction, so causing things that are hard to vaccinate for to work better, acting as a sort of adjuvant, and also possibly speeding up the rate at which an immune reaction would occur after vaccination. And so if we're looking at, for example, things like dengue fever and Ebola, where time is of the essence, if we can speed up the rate at which a vaccine take occurs and the active immune fight against the pathogen occurs, this could really, really be a game changer. Of course, something like this could result in a runaway freight train, and so, or a sort of sorcerer's apprentice-like scenario where too much immune system activation actually kills the individual, and we certainly see that occasionally with the influenza virus, so we don't want to go there. It will be a very nuanced and difficult course to turn this into standard therapy, but I think it has enormous potential, and if it's not this particular molecule, sooner or later we'll find another one that will act as the selective button that we can push to really turn on the immune system and direct it against something and speed up that process. Very exciting times to be in medicine, let me tell you. Let's see, we had an off-air comment. Thanks for recommending Qigong. I don't have any details but on why that is, but you're very welcome. And I certainly find Qigong very, very helpful and teach some of the very simple basic moves to my patients. And just as a note from the trenches, that's being very successful in people with anxiety disorders. Now, just on the heels of my extolling the virtue of immunology and new vaccine development, this article about the dynamics of vaccination and how it destabilizes the disease system. This is coming out of research done at the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine and Clemson University and was recently published in the journal Epidemiology and Infection. In this study, scientists used mathematical modeling to examine the quirks of infectious disease transmission and found that, at least in the case of dengue fever, which was what was studied for this modeling, that paradoxically, when you start vaccinating a population, you will actually create transient spikes in the disease, possibly leading to little mini epidemics. Now, that sounds weird, doesn't it? In the case of dengue, this vaccine is not a live virus vaccine, so it's not because people are getting sick from the vaccine. It's actually because it is because of herd immunity. Now, in most countries that have dengue fever, for example, in Thailand, the disease is prevalent. So about 80% of children will have had two infections by the age of 11 and develop resistance. The problem is, if you start to use a vaccine, it will provide some partial but not complete protection, and it will interrupt the natural sort of steady state rate of infections occurring among children. So in the beginning, the vaccine will slow the numbers of children getting the disease for a while. But as the effect of the vaccine attenuates, and then perhaps you have a monsoon year and you end up with more mosquitoes that year, you'll have more vectors for dengue, and because you won't have wiped it out completely, and you'll have a whole bunch of people who are either who are only partially protected because they didn't get the two infections that gave them complete protection. They only got a vaccine that gave them partial protection. You'll get a lot of secondary cases and actually a temporary spike in infections. So that's going to look very odd out there in Africa and Asia where they're starting to vaccinate, and suddenly they're seeing more cases of the disease a year or two later. Hard to understand until you step back and look at the overall population dynamics. Now, of course, in the long run, the vaccine works because after 10 or 15 years or so, everyone has gotten vaccinated and gotten a secondary infection and gotten now permanently immune. But the point was that the first infection wasn't that they get is really the second because they were vaccinated. So they get the two vaccine immune reaction and they aren't as sick when they get the real dengue. But the number of cases initially will spike oddly in this scenario. So something for us to be prepared for. And I just like the concept of the unintended consequences. And I'm very grateful for these people for doing the mathematical modeling, because I think it shows that even though we think we know what we're doing, when we perturb a system, it can have the opposite effect from that which we intend. Coming up later in the program, we'll do some email. And I also have some interesting stories linked to the microbiome that I hope we'll get to. But first, we're going to go to our first caller, and that's Tom in Salinas. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I heard you get a call from someone recommending the Qigong, and I'm on my way right now to facilitate a class at the Marina Library that's free. And I do it at the VA in Fort Ord. And usually patients that come in, that's for something functional, like falls or balance. But I found that a lot of them have anxiety, and they tell me that when they're doing the Tai Chi or the Qigong, they feel these huge anxiety attacks coming, and they can just kind of watch them come and go without buying into it or reacting to it. And hearing that's very rewarding. You know, they come in for something functional, and it's a mind thing with them, too.
Oh, yeah. The mind-body interaction, of course, we're all totally aware of it, butterflies in your stomach before you give a speech or something like that.
Right.
But we've been trained by our culture to sort of ignore it. And the point to make is this is a total two-way street. I mean, the body can affect the mind, but the mind can the mind can affect the body, and you can exploit that. You can use movement. And there's something, my subjective experience, because I have very, very active monkey mind, obviously, fast clock speed on my thoughts, very impatient and rapid speech, all of that. And when I am doing a complex movement where I need to be concentrating on what my right and left ankles, wrist, toes, and elbows are doing, there's just no room for the chatter. I can't do the pose right and move to the next pose and still worry about Mrs. Jones and her low back and whether I misdiagnosed that. It just can't happen. So as a result, I'm where I am in the moment. And most of our anxieties have nothing to do with the moment we're in. That's what makes them so hard to chase down with psychiatry, because they are about the future, they're about the past, they're about dread, and they're primarily subconscious, so they're hard to get to through any kind of conscious manipulation. But somehow the focus on movement and the focus on the breath is at a level that is able to just, like you said, you are rooted in the spot and the anxiety washes over you, just like when I stand on the edge of the ocean and I let a wave wash over me. I feel the push, I feel the pull when the water flows back over my legs, but I'm still in the same place, and I'm just walking along, and the water is moving, and I'm just walking along, and that's what happens with the Tai Chi or the Qigong.
Yeah, but, and some of the most rewarding stuff with it is like when you hear a patient say that, you know, even after a month and a half, hey, I can pull up my pants now without leaning against the wall. Or I can put my socks and shoes on now. And then, you know, they lapse, and then they realize all of a sudden they can't do that anymore, and they come back to it. It's really growing a lot, and the people that come together, they not only, it's not just a one-on-one with a practitioner, but they're working with the community, and it removes a lot of isolation and judgments and things. I think it's a wonderful practice for physicians and stuff to recommend.
I agree. I'd like to see Tai Chi in every park, in every neighborhood, in the mornings. It doesn't really take a formal class. It's great that it's great that you're teaching, but all it takes is two or three people who've taken your classes who live in the same trailer park to get out there.
We have a trailer park going, and Saturday morning at the library, we just get together. If you show up, you show up. If you don't, you don't. There's no judgments. It's you just get together for an hour on Saturday morning and enjoy.
We need to make this go viral, don't we?
Right. It's happening. It's happening.
When I went to China in 1984 as a young medical student, I would see this riding to the hospital on the bus in the mornings. Every park, every open square, there would be all of these, and they were always older people out there doing Tai Chi. And it's still true in China today, perhaps not as universally, but I was very struck by it. And it was a good example, and I'd love to see that happening, blossoming, going viral across the United States. I think it would do us a world of good.
All right.
Well, thank you, and thank you for what you do, contributing to the community like that.
I get so much more out of it than I put in.
It's true.
I feel like I'm stealing.
No, you're not. No, you're not. All right. Well, thank you for the call. Bye-bye. And Frank in Santa Cruz has something to say. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the show.
Yeah. Good morning, Dr. Dunn.
Good morning.
And I really enjoy your program.
Thanks.
And I have a story about, I'm a prostate cancer survivor, and this is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. And I also, tonight at the Kumba Jazz Center is the Songfest, annual Songfest. It's free at 5 o'clock, and it's a wonderful event with great musicians and good music, and then information about prostate cancer. But I can tell you my story. I my family had a history more of heart disease, and so I never thought that much about cancer. But luckily, my doctor ordered a PSA test, and it started at about 2 and then went up to 4 and then eventually up to 7. And the digital exam showed nothing, no problems, and I didn't have any other symptoms. So the only thing that alerted me to it was was getting that PSA test and getting a baseline early so mm-hmm. I could see the rate of change
right.
in it. And I had a biopsy, and it came back with a Gleason of 6. And so there was cancer. And that Gleason of 6, you know, you could do active surveillance or have surgery. But because I had a history that a doctor had my mother take DES, which is synthetic estrogen, I guess, when she was pregnant with me, I, you know, realized I maybe, because I'd done research on my background, that mm-hmm. I should be, you know, watch it more carefully. And I decided on having the surgery and had the surgery locally in Santa Cruz. And during the pathology after the surgery, it turned out to be a Gleason 7 and right near the membrane. So I had, it was a very good thing, and I had some inflammation there. It was a very good thing that I did the surgery.
Right. It sounds like it was worse than the biopsy indicated, and that does happen. So, and close to the membrane is always bad, because once you get across that membrane, we call that metastatic cancer, and that's never good. So please continue.
Yeah. So luckily, because I caught it then, I get my PSA tested every 3 to 6 months now, and it's now 3 years later after the surgery, and I have no recurrence, and my PSA is undetectable. So, you know, but if I hadn't had that, if my doctor hadn't given me the PSA test originally, mm-hmm. I would have had no clue that I had cancer.
Well, your story is, in fact, one of many people. The problem we have is that a lot of the cancers we turn up are, in fact, Gleason 2s or 3s. And, of course, in doing those biopsies, some people actually have a complication from the biopsy.
True.
And as if you step back and do a public health analysis of it, it depends on what you use as your endpoint. If you use as your endpoint survival, you know, death from prostate cancer, then it's hard to justify doing PSAs for the entire population, because those 2s and 3s bring down the stats. You know, those people would not have died no matter what from that prostate cancer. And so they dilute out, if you will, the cases like yourself where it probably was a lifesaver. And we run it, I'm glad you called, because this is, you know, this is that terrible gray area of medicine, and you're one of the people who benefited from the old screening protocols, and also because you had increased risk, the current recommendations would be for you to for people with extra risk factors, so family history, exposure to DES, which I believe is a synthetic progesterone, not a synthetic estrogen, but I could be wrong about that. Anyway,
right.
The point is, it was a synthetic hormone in women. Daughters, it causes cervical cancer because their cervix didn't form properly. And in men, it increases their risk of prostate cancer. And so, yes, indeed, your doctor was doing exactly the right thing to test you. We are looking at the same thing with mammograms now. And the controversy there is that we're having a hard time showing that mammograms in 40-year-olds affect survival, because those cancers tend to be aggressive and hard to find, and the mammograms don't find them. So what do we do? Do we chuck the mammograms out completely? Which is what, of course, the insurance companies have stopped paying for them, because they're like, well, if it's not recommended, we don't have to pay for it. What I worry about is that as we think about this and try to do the correct thing in terms of our global epidemiological mathematics, and also, of course, that's what's economically cheaper, that there will be losers, people like yourself, whose cancers will be missed. But on the other hand, with prostate cancer surveillance, the complications and the downside of taking out a cancer that wouldn't kill you anyway is pretty huge. So it's a knotty problem, and I don't see that there's an obvious right answer here, but I really thank you for calling in and sharing your story.
Sure, and I think that it's just really important that men take responsibility for their own health and not just hide their heads in the sand. That, you know, if you do have any family history of cancer or, you know, something that might lead you as a higher risk person, that it's really important to get that PSA test and, you know, if you know you have that history, and be knowledgeable. And I know a lot of it. Hopefully new genetic research will help to determine which cancers are aggressive and which are not, you know, depending on.
Yes, I think right now they need a lot of tissue. And if they can get it down to the point where they just need a little bit of tissue, then that's something you could get off of a biopsy, then we're in business with really starting to personalize cancer therapy. You make a very good point there.
Right. Well, thank you. And I hope your audience can come to the Songfest tonight. It's free. It's great music. And at the Kumba Jazz Center at 5.
All right. Kumba at 5, Songfest, Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to answer a quick question from Susan in Soquel. This one's kind of date-stamped, if you will. Three friends broke out with scabies on or before August 16th. They will host a celebration of life on September 13th. Treatment is underway, but possibly only half of what is prescribed. What's the chance they'll expose their 200 friends to scabies? Well, Susan, thought I'd better get back to you on this one. The chance is minimal. Transmission of scabies takes fairly prolonged body-to-body contact, so minimal hugging should not be a problem, particularly if the people have been treated through at least one cycle of the escapicides that are put on the body. So should be okay, but I would certainly not sit on anybody's lap. So lap dancing is out for this celebration of life, but aside from that, I think you're good. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Melinda in Soquel. Hello, Melinda. Welcome to the program.
Hi. There's a new study that I just read that was fairly extensive, showing that descendants of Eastern European Jews, mm-hmm. and I think they did this study in Israel, have a higher risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer, completely not linked with family history of cancer. So it's independent of family history.
Well, so
they have the genetic markers.
You mean they have the BRCA 1 and 2, but they
right.
don't have a family history?
Without family history.
Okay, so that's really no surprise. Let me explain. If you have, there's a statistically higher probability of cancer if you have the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 mutation. And these are mutations in proofreader genes, effectively, that help protect damaged DNA. So if the damage to our DNA occurs all the time and we have these protective things that go in there and fix it, and if those aren't as good or as effective or as efficient because they themselves are mutated, then you're going to have a statistically higher rate of cancer, right?
That's what they're saying.
Right. So now if there's something called variable penetrance in genetics, and so there's a range of risk associated with having a BRCA1. In some cohorts, it's like some of the studies that have looked at it have come up with a 35% lifetime risk of cancer. Others have come up with an 85% lifetime risk, looking at different subgroups, different ethnic groups, or different countries. So the people who have BRCA1 in Finland, for example, their lifetime risk of breast cancer works out to 35% based on family history, whereas in Israel, maybe it's 85%. And so it depends on where you look. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you there's other DNA at work that we haven't identified that affects these lineages. And effectively, the more inbred the population, when you have a mutation like this, the more inbred the population, the more likely that you're going to have problems. And that's, you know, why hybrid vigor and mixing up the DNA is good, because you have these recessives. And if you end up with an inbred population, you get more matched sets of bad recessive genes than if everybody is mixing up the DNA and you only end up with one bad recessive, which hopefully the other half of that gene, the one you got from dad or mom that isn't mutated, can pick up the slack and protect you.
So my dad is Russian.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm half.
Okay. So you're Ashkenazi Jew on your mom's side.
Dad's side.
On your dad's side. Okay.
And they said it can be passed.
Yes, because it isn't on the X chromosome. It is.
And all of our family has autoimmune disease and reproductive issues.
You know, oddly enough, a history of autoimmune disease is actually a negative risk factor for cancer.
Oh, really?
Oddly, it's weird, huh?
Well, but no, not really, because that
overactive that immune system. Yeah, so it sort of makes sense that it's hypervigilant and it's ready to attack anything. So it also it's more likely to attack the cancer, the nascent cancer cells. So, you know, it's silver lining cloud of that particular cloud. So have you been tested for the BRCA1
and
the BRCA2?
I haven't been tested. This research, I just read it this past week.
Okay.
New.
Yeah. So
I was thinking that I should get the tested for those two.
The recommendation is anyone of that ancestry should consider testing. You can, and that's.
But nobody ever asked me if I was of that ancestry. They don't.
No, we don't. You know, there's so many. Look at it this way. If we asked every single question that we could possibly ask for risk. Oh my God, you know.
I know.
What I'd like is I'd like people to sit down and spend 2 hours at a computer answering a whole bunch of questions, which I will never have to read all of those answers, because
the computer would
give me the ones that I care about and bring them to the top, and I might get 20 things that I needed to know about that patient.
And I have a really excellent doctor. She's bright and caring. And
But just from a feasibility standpoint,
we
have too much knowledge, and I can't funnel it all through my brain.
No.
In the 15 minutes I'm allowed for that patient, and then, you know, funnel the next set. We need expert systems, and we need filters. And
my insurance definitely won't pay for it, but I wonder how much it would cost to have that test done?
Well, the cheapest way to do it would be to use one of the simple genetic testing services like 23andMe.
23andMe. Okay.
They are now forbidden from the FDA, by the FDA, of giving you any interpretation.
Oh, that's okay.
But you can. But there are secondary services, and that I'm aware of. Don't have any names to suggest. But basically, for a fee, they'll take your raw 23andMe data and massage it for you, because the FDA left the back door open in the sense that 23andMe can only sell a medical test, but they can't interpret it. But
so
once you have the
medical,
but somebody else can interpret it, and they're
I could show it to my doctor.
You know, your doctor is not gonna be able to make heads nor tails of it, because the raw data dump from 23andMe, as I just looked at it the other day with a patient, and it uses a different nomenclature for the genes, and so it doesn't call it BRCA1 and BRCA2. It has like this chromosome and this coded location, and so you need to decode it. But there are services that'll do that for you, and that'll cost you $99 to find out if you have the versions of BRCA that 23andMe tests for, but which is most of them.
So 23andMe will tell me if I have BRCA1 and 2?
It'll tell you if you have the most common variants, and let's be clear here. It will not tell you for sure that you don't have one of the uncommon variants. And that's the problem with the current state-of-the-art of the genetic testing, and that's why the FDA came down on them, is because they were giving that percentages, you know, your risk is 23% higher or 33% lower for disease X, and that was completely bogus.
It's
the baloney, exactly. You cannot possibly make that kind of a statement based on what they're testing.
Right.
It is, however, a quick and dirty way to do that. The actual full-on genetic testing of the entire segment for all possible mutations, so far as I know, is still running about $1,000. So affordable if you're, you know, willing to forego a
Is the BRCA1 and BRCA2, is that also the one that indicates ovarian?
Yeah, that, okay. Well, some in, well, increased risk of ovarian, it is by no means the only genetics that puts you at risk for ovarian. So it's kind of like we have a test for something and that gets all the focus, but there's this great murky pool of stuff that we don't have a test for.
Right.
That's why we really need complete genomic testing. And instead of it being developed by industry, which is what's happening now, you know, you've got all these companies trying to develop machines. This should be being subsidized by the global governments of the world, because this is something that we all need. And it isn't something that we should be letting industry develop, and then industry is going to have a patent and a copyright on it and be able to charge an arm and a leg for the data.
Well, we're too busy having large corporations buy voting blocks.
Well, you're right about that. But anyway, let's stay on topic. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Hal, who always knows more than I do about everything, I'm serious, Hal, is here calling in about BRCA. Hi, Hal. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Not quite true. I'm calling because you know a lot more than I do about what I want to ask you about. Your first two calls really hit home. My family on my mother's side is rich in BRCA 1 and 2, and lots of cancers among my cousins, the next generation and the generation and my mother's generation. My mother, three-time cancer survivor. She's 100 now, but so my PSAs were always really low, but I heard your first caller and am a little concerned about just relying on the annual checkup.
Well, I would first say if you're getting a PSA every year, that the inventor of the PSA, by the way, says it shouldn't be used for screening, but there is a refinement of it that I think is decent, and that's the rate of change of the PSA. So it's a, call it a screening test. There are a lot of false positives because as you age, your prostate can grow, it can become inflamed, that'll kick the PSA up. But if your PSA is going up by more than about 0.3 to 0.5 points of a point a year, that's a red flag to investigate further. So if a person say 2.0 and then 2 years later they're 2.5, I'm like so not worried about it. But if they're 2.0 and 3 years later they're 4.5, that's a little fast. And then a year later they're 6.0, it's like, okay, we're going in. Because that's too fast. And
mine were always low, but my healthcare provider, the clinic, doesn't order them.
No, they won't, because they changed the recommendations, and now if you order it, it won't be paid for by the insurance, and then two things happen. First of all, the lab climbs down my throat and says, you need to supply another code to justify this test, otherwise we're going to bill the patient.
It's all about coding, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And then the patient, you can't use the screening codes anymore because it's no longer officially to be screened. And then the patient, you know, patients everywhere, and everybody effectively within the sound of my voice is a patient one time or another. You got to be careful what you yell at your doctor for, because it has a ripple effect throughout the entire population. We remember that we got in trouble because I get in trouble all the time for ordering a hemoglobin A1C, okay? That is a really good screening test for prediabetes, much better than a blood sugar. It is, however, not paid for screening. So effectively, one either has to take the risk that the patient's going to be mad at you for a $200 bill or a $150 bill for a test that you really think they need and is beneficial, or you have to try to come up with some code that isn't, you know, completely fraudulent that will get it paid for. I don't like to be playing around with this calculus, but a world driven by insurance companies, this is how it works.
Well, and when the gentleman called who had the prostate cancer, you made the comment about, you know, from a public health perspective.
Exactly.
And my reaction to that is, you know, the broad population statistics don't impress me because I might be, you know, in the tail of the distribution and they're irrelevant to me.
Exactly. And for those of us who can think about it that way and have some discretionary income, I have a short list of things that you might consider paying for at your annual that may not be funded by your insurance. And that would be an hsCRP, which is an inflammatory marker, which if it's persistently high is a risk factor for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and a whole bunch of things. And if you have, if you're a DES son or you have a family history of prostate cancer, a PSA, and if you have, and everybody over 50 should be getting monitored for the development of diabetes because it is literally rampant in that age group. It's like 50% of my patients, and I have a fairly exceptionally healthy crowd of people in my practice, but 50% of my patients over 50 are showing signs of metabolic syndrome, you know, elevated blood sugar, insulin resistance. And it's just, if we don't find it early, then all of those epigenetic changes, I'm always ranting about epigenetics, well, it's happening right now when you, you know, eat that bagel. So all of the epigenetic changes accumulate and gain momentum so that by the time the person will screen out as positive on the screening tests that we use, they're going to need drugs. Now, I don't think this is a conspiracy, but I will point out that the way our current system is set up, we ensure that by the time we start to intervene, the person's already so sick that they need drugs. I think
So let me ask you specifically about that. I never even considered I might be at risk for diabetes. I'm 72, but my mother's father, and that's the side where the BRCA gene is. He's my only grandparent who died before the age of 90. He died at 72. He was diabetic, and one of my mother's brothers was diabetic.
Maybe you should be screening a hemoglobin A1C and just, you know, getting out the checkbook and paying for it. If eventually after 6 months or so, it filters through all of the levels and you finally end up with a bill, just pay it. And I wanted to put out there that my producer went and looked up the costs through LabCorp for patient pay hemoglobin A1C. And that was $27, and hsCRP is $25. I want to mention that if you go in and you buy things from LabCorp retail, patient retail, the prices are pretty good. If you make them bill your insurance and your insurance turns it down, then you get charged the inflated price that LabCorp and all the other labs charge the insurance in order both to cover the overhead of billing them and the fact that when they do get paid, if they get paid, they get paid at 30% on the dollar or so. So there's this complex pricing structure that's an artifact of our fragmented healthcare system that really, really backfires on people who have high deductibles or who have circumstances where they don't have health insurance, although that's thankfully becoming less and less common. Most people now have at least some health insurance, and that usually helps them get lower prices.
Okay. Now, I was going to call you this morning for something completely different. So my question was about my knee. I had an MRI because I had a lot of pain. They said I have a lax ACL and some micro tears at the bottom where it's connected, but that it wasn't advised to do surgery because I have so much arthritis in both my knees. And I got a cortisone shot, which has helped a lot. But I really want to do whatever I can to try to improve the performance of that knee. I still have some pain from time to time. Mm-hmm. And I looked at collagen and hyaluronic acid, and I wonder if you have some recommendations about those.
Well, it depends on what you mean by improve the performance. Hyaluronic acid is going to be a lubricant. It can act as a pro-inflammatory, and then you get an anti-inflammatory overreaction. So sometimes you feel worse for a week or two and then a lot better. Cortisone, you've already had all the anti-inflammatory you're going to need, so the hyaluronic acid would really just be acting as a lubricant if you went ahead and injected. If the problem with the performance is pain, you might get some benefit there. If the problem is the wobbliness and unsteadiness and swelling, I would say a program of physical therapy and the use maybe of a neoprene brace is where you should be going. And strengthening those muscles.
I used up Medicare's allowance of the physical therapy already.
Too damn bad. Go online, go to YouTube, pull down some exercises.
Yeah.
If you didn't learn anything at physical therapy, which you should have been sent home with a home program, something I will just put out there to physical therapists, if my patients go and see you and they can't demonstrate the exercises that they're supposed to be doing after 3 sessions and after 6 or 8 sessions, they don't have a home program that they're doing, you are not doing your job.
And my guy is great, and he did exactly that, and I do have home exercises.
Are you doing them?
Yes.
Okay, good.
But that's because of my passion for pitching. Even at my advanced age, I'm still playing hardball and pitching, and I need that left knee to land on
in
my delivery.
Gotcha. Well, that's a pretty high demand thing, I'm thinking. You know, if you're pitching, that you're coming down on that knee pretty hard.
Yeah, they said it's probably the worst thing I could do for my knee, but when I use it up, they'll get me a new one.
I'm going to not comment on that, okay?
And I won't be able to pitch, and my reaction is I probably won't be able to reach home plate in the air either.
Okay.
But what I was looking for was comfort and maybe some restorative effect or positive effect to improve the performance given the advanced state of the arthritis there.
Well, all right. You love pitching, and I'm going to tell you that, and you know it, you're burning through that cartilage fast, and there's not really that much medical science can do except tell you that you're going to end up with a knee replacement, which, by the way, they will tell you can't pitch after you have that knee replacement.
Right. No, I've been told all that. I know all that.
All right.
Probably near the end of my pitching career anyway.
Okay, Hal. Well, thank you very much for the call. I don't really have any further specific recommendations for you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye. I want to take a moment and just throw this out to Peter in the United States, who's wants to know about thinning fingernails. 77-year-old, he's got fingernails thinning and horizontal lines appearing on most of them, and these lines grow toward the top, can cause moderate pain when they break off. So, Peter, I'm going to advise you to take a B-complex and some extra biotin. Take about 15 milligrams of biotin and about 15 milligrams of zinc, and call us and send me another email in about 3 months and let me know if those fingernails got better, because I think it's probably nutritional deficiencies and those replacements that I just gave you should do the trick. And now moving on to Regina. Hello, Regina.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm just calling because I had an episode, I guess you call it, last week in the evening that I kind of squished my finger on kind of a big speaker, and it hurt quite a bit. And then I was at a kind of unfamiliar place and maybe a little bit stressed out, and I couldn't find any ice, and I was kind of freaking out. And then all of a sudden, I felt dizzy and I fainted just briefly. I mean, I was like, it was getting worse and worse, and I was sitting down, and so I didn't hurt myself or anything. But I'm kind of, I haven't fainted for, years, and perhaps it was vasovagal, just a reaction.
Yeah,
but I'm
just
a little bit concerned.
Yeah, I think that's likely. How old are you?
54.
And do you kick any blood pressure medications?
No.
Do you think you were dehydrated at the time?
Dehydrated.
Had you not been drinking that much fluid? Was your urine concentrated? You may not remember that, but just asking.
No, I don't remember.
Okay. All right. So let's just talk about syncope reactions. They can occur essentially when the blood pressure drops. You lose enough oxygen flow to the brain that the brain says, we need to be horizontal, and down you go. And once you're horizontal, 15 seconds, 30 seconds later, tops, you've got the blood, the brain has rebooted and you wake up and things are fine. Typical faint has this kind of progressive thing. You'll feel maybe a little nauseated, sweaty. Possibly you'll get a brownish coloration coming in from the sides of your visual field. And these are all very reassuring things if I get a history of those when someone tells me they passed out, because the cardiac sudden death sort of faint doesn't do that. It's just a sudden drop to the floor with no warning. And when I hear that one, I'm thinking seizure or significant cardiac abnormality. But if there's a nice, good prodrone, even in a 50-year-old, I'm less worried. But if you were 20, I wouldn't tell you to go to the doctor over this. But since you are arguably old enough to have some heart disease, you probably need to be screened at least with an EKG and a rhythm strip. Do you have access to medical services?
Yes.
Okay. So I would go in, get them to check your blood pressure lying down and then standing, and get them to do an EKG that they should be standard part of a fainting workup, and a rhythm strip. And what they'll look at is they'll look for any little blips on the heart rhythm. So if this happens again, a second time would merit the use of a 24-hour monitor, a Holter monitor, looking for substantial irregularities in the heartbeat that could trigger faints. And if those are negative, it's probably the first level of screening is probably adequate unless there's a second event. And then it's hydrate and maybe a little extra salt in your diet. And certainly if you were on medications, we'd be taking a look at changing those meds.
Okay.
Okay.
But as far as the vasovagal, is that...
That's very likely what you had. That's a syncopal episode.
And you said the prodrone, I don't really...
In other words, symptoms that happened before the event.
Oh, yeah. I was nauseated and...
You had all the classic symptoms, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't remember the visual field, but...
No, that isn't invariable. I said sometimes on that one.
Okay.
Well,
all right. Well, yeah, I'll be going into the doctor anyhow.
Yeah, go get checked out. And,
like in a week or something.
Yeah, ask for a rhythm strip. And certainly, if it happens again, it becomes something you must pursue promptly, okay?
All right, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Let's see where we are. We have time for some really interesting stories about gut flora. And you know, microbiome and epigenetics are two of my current threads on this program. And I try to bring you stuff as it comes up. We've talked before about the possibility that the flora in your stomach might be associated with how much you weigh. And in fact, I heard through a friend that there are people in, at least in our Silicon Valley, who are doing their own fecal transplants with stool from thin people, trying to turn their current fat person self into a thin person. You know, it's a do-it-yourself universe out here in the Silicon Valley, so it doesn't surprise me. But anyway, this research coming out of both University of New Mexico, Albuquerque, and University of California, San Francisco, is about how the bacteria in your gut may actually be influencing directly what you want to eat. Now, certain bacteria, for example, prefer carbohydrates. Prevotella species really like carbohydrates. Bifidobacteria, one of the probiotics, really like fiber. And so if you're eating a high-fiber diet, you're going to have more bifidobacteria. If you've got a lot of Prevotella because you are eating a lot of carbohydrates, when the Prevotella will actually manipulate your behavior, and they have several mechanisms of doing this, chiefly the vagus nerve. There are 100 million neurons in the gut nervous system, and they all connect directly to the base of the brain, right at the medulla, through the vagus nerve. And these enteric nerves have receptors that actually react to the presence of certain bacteria, as well as the breakdown products of bacterial metabolism. That's probably why it doesn't matter whether your probiotics are dead or alive, your nervous system doesn't know the difference. Anyway, if you block the vagus nerve, you get drastic weight loss. And if you stimulate it, you get excessive eating behavior, even in rats that are full. And it's thought that the bacteria or byproducts of their metabolism may actually be directly stimulating these neurons. We also know that the neurons, that bacteria in your intestines actually secrete dopamine, which is the reward hormone, and serotonin. And they may also actually have an effect on taste. It turns out that after you do gastric bypass, you drastically alter the gut microbiota, and the food preferences and taste receptors in people who've had that surgery change drastically. It's not clear what the mechanism is, but it's really fascinating that these bacteria are capable of actually talking to our brain and telling it what to order for dinner. Another interesting finding in the microbiome world is a study that looked at professional athletes. So this was a team of soccer players, and they had a control group of people who were active, of normal body weight, but not professional athletes. And of course, the control participants were maybe getting a brisk walk once a day as opposed to 4 or 5 hours running around on the soccer field. So substantial difference in activity. The soccer players had drastically more, just basically double the amount of variability in their gut flora. Their dietary differences were not that great. They ate more protein, but aside from that, there wasn't a very substantial difference in diet, so it's probably not attributed to that. But they found very substantial amounts of different variability, and also higher microbiota density. So the professional athletes had more and better variety of gut microflora. So again, we're getting back to the old refrain, exercise and eating right helps you stay alive. But of course, now we're digging down here on Ask Dr. Dawn to exactly why that is and why it's so important. I have time for a quick final email, and so I wanted to respond to Cannon in Santa Cruz about the tamoxifen and sleep study I talked about a couple issues ago. Cannon's just completed treatment for breast cancer, and her doctor just dismissed the study of tamoxifen and said it doesn't matter. We were talking about how light at night can impair the benefit from tamoxifen. She's been taking Arimidex and wants to know if there's a crossover between this and the light issue. And yes, Cannon, I think there probably is. So what I'm currently recommending for any woman who is on any kind of hormone suppressant therapy, whether it's a hormone blocker or a hormone suppressant, to use a mask at night that is, basically a set of blinders so that you don't get any light, because it does seem like that has profound effect on melatonin, which appears to be critical for the anti-cancer effect of tamoxifen. It's all about the hormones, ladies. We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Please keep those calls and letters coming, and I'll be back next week. Until then, so long and stay healthy.